Now let's look at the other prophets to see if we can correlate some more with Old Testament eschatology. Let's look at the book of Ezekiel. Ezekiel 37, verse 1. The hand of the Lord was on me, and he brought me out by the Spirit of the Lord and set me in the middle of a valley. It was full of bones. This is what the sovereign Lord says to these bones, verse 5. I will make breath enter you, and you will come to life. I will attach tendons to you, and will make flesh come upon you and cover you with skin. And then finally, he says, I will put breath in you, and you will know, or you will come to life. Then you will know that I am the Lord. So what's the progression? He's looking at a valley. It's all bones. Then he says, you're going to get sinews or tendons, and then eventually you'll get muscles and flesh. And then there will be skin, but there'll be kind of these lifeless bodies. Picture Adam, when we read in Genesis chapter 2, he's a body, but God breathed into him the nephesh, the spirit. And the same thing is a picture here, a valley of bones, tendons, muscles, skin, and then he breathes in life. Well, at this point, I'm sure you can see that this shows that the nation of Israel will be regathered at the end of history. Any questions? No, you're like, that doesn't, how do you know that that's Israel? Well, we don't. Until we get to verse 11, just a couple verses later. I'm going to be a broken record, but here it is. Whenever you see symbolism in the Old or New Testament, you're like, well, oh man, this is so freaky. This is so far out. This kind of reminds me of the old, is it the 1960s version, Clash of the Titans? Where it's claymation and they have skeletons that come up and they fight. You haven't seen it. Okay, anyways, great old movie. And Jason and the Argonauts and everything. It looks like something really freaky and weird, but then you're like, what does this mean? And you read a half a dozen verses later, then he said to me, son of man, these bones are the people of Israel. It defines what the vision is. Verse 12, therefore prophesy and say to them, this is what the sovereign Lord says. My people, I am going to open your graves and bring you up from them. I will bring you back to the land of Israel. I will take the Israelites out of the nations where they have gone. Verse 21, I will gather them from all around and bring them back into their own land. I will make them one nation in the land on the mountains of Israel. There will be one king over all of them, and they will never again be two nations or be divided into two kingdoms. Ever since the time of Solomon, where he had his son, and then the who he thought to be the rightful heir to the throne, a civil war broke out between Jeroboam and Rehoboam. This would be about the 900s BC, during just after the time of Solomon. You had Judah go off to the north and Israel to the south. And here, God is saying this was going to be one nation. They will never again be two nations. This will be the nation of Israel as it was created under David and Solomon. They will no longer defile themselves with their idols. There's going to be a purification of religion during this time. My servant David will be king over them, and they will all have one shepherd. They will follow my laws and be careful to keep my decrees. Has this happened yet? No. Well, sort of. Half of the people on earth who are Jewish have been regathered into the real estate of Israel. But what about this part about them not having any idolatry? Is there idol worship in Israel? I guess not. But there's mass anti-religious sentiment. As we said already, half of the nation, they're either non-religious or anti-religious. Only 12% consider themselves to be religious. And 5% are actual Bible-believing Orthodox Jews. So this hasn't been fulfilled in its entirety yet. What about this part? My servant David will be king over them. So this is referring to sometime in the future, because this hasn't been fulfilled, correct? Now, when it says, my servant David, you might be like, are they going to pull out the smelling salts and David is going to be the king over them again? No, whenever the term David is used in the prophetic literature, I'm thinking of Jeremiah 23, Ezekiel 37, and other places as well. When David pops up as king over Israel, what it's referring to is the Davidic covenant, where God told David in 2 Samuel 7 that I'm going to make a nation with you, a throne, and one of your descendants will always sit on the throne. I will discipline him, but I will never reject him, and it'll be an eternal covenant. And so this is the final ancestor, Messiah, who is going to rule and reign where? In Israel. Over whom? Over the Israelites. And this is going to happen when? At the end of history. Again, he says, David, my servant, will be their prince forever. Whenever David comes in, Messiah, that's it. It's going to be forever. The nation of Israel will be protected, and that's all. I will put my sanctuary or temple among them forever. So once this temple is built, it's never going away. What happens after this, though? Well, we jump into Ezekiel 38, and we read of an incredible war that goes down. Ezekiel 38, verse 2, Son of man, set your face toward Gog of the land of Magog, the prince of Rosh, Meshach, and Tubal. Well, let's start with Gog. Who's Gog? This could be an individual ruler. Notice he's called the Prince of Rosh. The Prince of Rosh. It could also, if you go back and do the etymology of this term, which is in my book, Endless Hope or Hopeless End, if you want a nice book to help you go to sleep at night, you could read all about this. If you do the etymology, you discover that this is referring to modern-day Turkey. So if it's a nation, it's referring to Turkey, most likely. And if it's an individual, then it's just some future individual that rules over Rosh. What about Magog? What is Magog? Well, the Black Sea in the broad area of Russia. I'm giving you the Cliff's Notes, the Spark Notes of my work on the subject. Where Magog, it's somewhere in that general vicinity. David E. Garland, in his commentary on Ezekiel, says that this position is generally accepted. When it refers to Magog, it's somewhere in the Black Sea in the broad area of Russia. What about the Prince of Rosh? The Prince of Rosh. This is very disputed. But I'm not going to give you all the different interpretations. I'm just going to give you the right one, which happens to be my interpretation. Of course, I'm kidding, but I'm going to give you what I think is most likely. Where I'm going to land really hard is that when this refers to the Prince of Rosh, this is not referring to an adjective. If you have the NIV, you're going to get an adjective here. When it says the Prince of Rosh, this is referring to a proper noun, Rosh, a place, not an adjective, as the NIV puts it. Clyde Billington, who in my estimation has done the most precise work on the Rosh people, he did three journal articles on this topic, each of which is 25 to 30 pages, and just goes through in scrupulous detail trying to figure out who or what is Rosh. Billington says this in part two. He says, quote, there were bands of Meshach, Tubal, and Rosh peoples living in or north of the Caucasus Mountains in what is today Russia. Now, the old dispensationalists, they used to say, Meshach, Tubal, and Rosh. Huh, Meshach. That kind of sounds like Moscow. And Tubal, that sounds like Tobolsk. And Rosh, Rosh, Russia, Rosh, Rosh. It's Russia. It's Rosh is Russia. Well, of course, everyone just ripped them to shreds. I mean, this was just so unscholarly, ridiculous, bizarre. Billington comes back and says, actually, okay, Meshach and Tubal, we'll get there. But Rosh, yeah, the thought that it's Rasha, that's totally false, totally wrong. However, when you actually do the study of who Rosh is or what Rosh is, it goes back to the actual modern-day area of Russia. He points out that the Byzantine Christians believed that the Rosh people existed in Russia, and this is in the 5th century A.D. So this isn't some kind of a modern idea that Rosh is Russia. This goes back to A.D. 438, where Byzantine Christians thought that the Rosh people were in Russia. Well, who or what are Meshach and Tubal? As I said before, they're not Moscow and Tobolsk. This would be modern-day Turkey, according to most commentators. Persia, this is easy, that's Iran, or Iran, if you prefer. Persia is Iran. Kush would be Sudan or Ethiopia. Kush would be the Sudan or Ethiopia. And Put would be modern-day Libya, most likely. Or possibly Algeria or Tunisia. That's also possible. But we're not exactly sure. Most likely it's modern-day Libya. Then we jump into verse 6. Also Gomer with all its troops and Beth Tamarga from the far north with all its troops and the many nations with you. Gomer is in modern day Turkey. So that is pretty well defined. And Beth Togarma. Beth Togarma. Boy, I cannot say that. Is modern-day Armenia. So if you're trying to figure out where these nation-states would exist today, of course, these are the ancient terms. Where would they be on today's map? That would be Armenia. Armenia. Prophesy, verse 14, and say to Gog, this is what the sovereign Lord says. Now, this could be Gog is a person, remember? Or it could be that Gog is Turkey. A nation. Or it could be that the person represents the nation. Regardless, prophesy and say to Gog, this is what the sovereign Lord says. In that day, when my people Israel are living in safety, will you not take notice of it? Here's a question to ponder. When have the Jewish people ever lived in safety? When have they just been sitting around going, ah, this is real nice. We're in plenty of safety now. That's never happened. I mean, at least not after this event. Maybe before the time of Ezekiel. But after the time of Ezekiel, that has never occurred. When they regathered in the 6th century B.C., and then they were attacked by the Greeks, then they were attacked by the Romans, then they were massacred in A.D. 70, then they were massacred again in A.D. 132 to 135, and then they've been dispersed. Okay, this is never, even today, they're in their land, they're not in safety. They're constantly fighting over there. You talk to people that go over to Israel to visit, and everyone has an automatic rifle or a weapon of some kind. They're ready to fight. This hasn't been fulfilled yet. This is still future. Then he says this, you will come from your place in the far north. North. You and many nations with you, all of them riding on horses, a great horde, a mighty army. An army from the north. You and many nations with you. So this isn't saying that once we categorize each one of these nations and understand who they are, then we know all the nations involved. These are just the nations which are named. So there could be more nations involved. Perhaps even the United States. Now, is the United States mentioned? Absolutely not. But it also says there's many nations and they haven't been mentioned here. We could be out of the picture. We don't know. So how would this fit? This would fit pretty well with our description of Daniel chapter 11, that a king from the north is going to come in. And there's also the king of the south and then the king from the west and then rumors from the east. where this figure is going to be hemmed in the nation of Israel. Just to put that in perspective, Israel is right here on the map. And if what I gave you, which I put in a considerable amount of study to make sure that the old ancient archaic names, you know, Gomer, Meshach, Tubal, Persia, to make sure those, I'm representing those on our actual real estate today. In other words, there's a one-to-one comparison that the ancient names are represented in modern day nations. If I'm right about that, these are all the nations that are being mentioned. So basically all the nations surrounding Israel. Does that make sense? So, in other words, this is the same picture that we see in Daniel chapter 11. That all the nations are surrounding Israel and they're all coming in to attack Israel. Verse 18. This is what will happen in that day. When Gog attacks the land of Israel, my hot anger will be aroused, declares the sovereign Lord. In my zeal and fiery wrath, I declare that at that time there shall be a great earthquake in the land of Israel. Now, this is going to be interesting because we're going to read prophet after prophet after prophet. They're going to be like, it's the end of history. All the nations are surrounding Israel. They're coming into an attack and plunder and rape and pillage and kill and murder. And at that time, there's a huge earthquake. They all mention this. So again, what I'm arguing here for is correlation. It's describing the same peoples, the same period of history, and now there's this earthquake which is mentioned. It's all correlating, locking in together. Verse 21, I will summon a sword against Gog on all my mountains, declares the sovereign Lord. Every man's sword will be against his brother. I will execute judgment on him with plague and bloodshed. I will pour down torrents of rain, hailstones, and burning sulfur on him and on his troops and on the many nations with him. And so I will show my greatness and my holiness, and I will make myself known in the sight of many nations. Then they will know that I am the Lord. So that, what's the picture? Big nation comes in, all these nations from multi-directions come in to attack Israel, and that's precisely the moment that God intervenes. There's an earthquake, and then God comes in and protects the nation of Israel. Here's a question which confronts us. If this is referring to the end of history, why horses? Why does it mention horses? Why are they riding horses? Why do they have sticks and spears and swords, if this is supposed to be future warfare? Specifically, they have horses, Ezekiel 38:4, swords, verse 4, verse 21, bows and arrows, Ezekiel 39:9, and war clubs, Ezekiel 39:9. Why are they fighting with clubs and sticks and stones and spears and swords and horses? Well, right away we can say, hold on a second, has this been fulfilled? Preterists would say, yeah, this was probably fulfilled in Esther chapter 9. Really? So it was fulfilled in Persia, first of all, not in Israel. And all the nations of the earth were coming up against it. And there was hail and rainstorms and torrents of blood and God's furious. No, nothing like this has been fulfilled. This has never happened. And so this still must be future. But this really is a fly in the ointment, isn't it? For a futurist like myself, I'm interpreting this and I'm saying, why do they have ancient weapons? Short answer, I don't know. Long answer, here's a few different options. First option is, it could be that they revert to ancient weapons. That something happens at this time that modern warfare is kind of put to a halt. We think of that quote from Albert Einstein, which is not an apocryphal quote. This is a real quote. He says, I know not with what weapons World War III will be fought, but World War IV will be fought with sticks and stones. His point was that whatever happens in World War III, it's going to set us back so tremendously that after a lot of this warfare occurs, we're going to be set back into the Dark Ages. When you think of nuclear war, when you think of EMPs, stuff like that, it could knock out a lot of the warfare and weapons that we have today. That's possible. So it could be that armies are picking up whatever they can and just trying to charge, go in and kill. It could be that they think that Israel is wiped out as well. And if they've lost their power and their weapons, maybe this is the time to go in, even if it's with swords and spears and everything else. This could be what's called phenomenological language, or let's just make that simple, metaphorical. Okay? Phenomenological language means I'm looking at something, I don't know how to describe it. And so I'm just going to use whatever language I can use to describe it. And so it could be that Ezekiel is seeing a vision of modern warfare, but he uses the language of his day to describe it. Or it could be metaphor. That's possible. It could be that, like a modern day general, he might say, send in the cavalry. Well, he doesn't literally mean send in the men on horses. That's the cavalry. Or he could say, they're going to die by the sword. He doesn't literally mean that they're going to be, you know, stabbed with swords or anything of the sort. But it's metaphorical language. Possible, I don't know. Not that good, because it seems like it's really describing something a little more literal than that. Some of the more extreme dispensational interpreters argue that in Hebrew, the function of the word is more important than its definition. So you're thinking, what's that saying? Well, some have argued, and I hope you can tell by my tone, I don't like this view, but some have argued that in Hebrew, a snake isn't a snake, it's literally a hisser. A horse isn't a horse, it's literally a leaper or a runner. And so when it says a bow and arrow, it's literally a shooter. A sword, it's a piercer. And so they've argued from this that perhaps the meaning of the words is describing something that has more technological force than could be described. Other dispensationals have critiqued this heavily. They don't buy it. It could be that this is a mixture. It could be that there's a mixture of advanced warfare, but Ezekiel isn't mentioning that piece. He's only mentioning the piece that he can describe. Maybe there's a mixture of hired soldiers that are fighting on horses and camels and swords and spears, as well as modern warfare. We could be stretching this, but in Ezekiel 39:9, it says, "You will come like a storm." Now, how does a storm come? On the ground or in the air? In the air. You will be like a cloud covering the land. This could be describing some kind of an aerial warfare. But he doesn't know how to describe it. So he uses the language of simile. Like a storm. Like a cloud. Like he's just looking up into the sky and he sees this picture where it's kind of like blotting out the land and he doesn't know how to describe it. He says, "You and all your troops and many peoples with you." So it could be that even in this same text, we're getting the picture of some kind of advanced warfare, but it's phenomenological. He doesn't know how to describe it, so he uses the nearest simile or analogy. It's possible. So there is the book of Ezekiel. Now, interestingly enough, so Ezekiel 37, that's the regathering of Israel. Ezekiel 38 and 39, this massive battle, most likely the battle of Armageddon, or at least one of the battles of Armageddon. And then Ezekiel 40, 41, 42, 43, 44, 45, 46, 47, 48 is all about the third temple. Remember we talked about that before? This new temple with all different measurements and different stories and floors and a river is going right through the middle of it. And when's that going to happen? It comes right on the heels of this big war. After this war is over, God's going to defend Israel. And then they're going to rebuild this incredible temple as a consequence. That's Ezekiel's picture. Now let's flip over to Zechariah. Again, these passages are in context. They're referring to the end of history. Zechariah 12:3, all the nations of the earth will be gathered against Israel. Oh, that's the same picture. The book of Daniel has it. Ezekiel had it. Now we got Zechariah. Verse 4, in that day, declares the Lord, I will strike every horse with bewilderment and its rider with madness. They will consume on the right hand and on the left all the surrounding peoples, while the inhabitants of Jerusalem again dwell on their own sites in Jerusalem. Almost like a regathering of Israel, where they get their land back, including Jerusalem, which hasn't been a reality since up until 1948 and then the Six-Day War in 1967, where they got back their land. They quadrupled their footprint in Israel, and they took over the city of Jerusalem. Well, verse 8, in that day the Lord will defend the inhabitants of Jerusalem. Same picture. So you got all the nations coming against Israel. The Jewish people are back in their land. And then God himself steps in and intervenes. And in that day, I will set about to destroy all the nations that come against Jerusalem. I will pour out on the house of David and on the inhabitants of Jerusalem the spirit of grace and of supplication, so that they will look on me whom they have pierced. This is a passage which is quoted twice in the New Testament. John is at 19:37 when they're looking up at the cross, and John says, this is to fulfill what was written. They will look on me whom they have pierced. And then in Revelation chapter 1, they will look on him whom they have pierced. And this is an interesting passage because who has been speaking this whole time in Zechariah chapter 12? Yahweh. God. And at this point, speaking in the first person, he says they will look on me, Yahweh, whom they have pierced. How can you pierce God? Unless you have an incarnation. And that's precisely what John believed. Well, it says they realized they pierced Jesus. They pierced their Messiah. They will mourn for him as one mourns for an only son, and they will weep bitterly over him like the bitter weeping over a firstborn. There's going to be a national mourning, realizing that we've pierced God. In that day, there will be great mourning in Jerusalem. The land will mourn, every family by itself. In that day, a fountain will be opened for the house of David, and for the inhabitants of Jerusalem, for sin and for impurity. And so there's going to be a national repentance, a national mourning, and a national realization on behalf of Israel that they realize we've pierced God. And how's it put it in 13:1? There's going to be a fountain opened for the sins and impurities of Israel. Those are going to be wiped clean. Let's flip forward to chapter 14. A day of the Lord is coming, Jerusalem, when your possessions will be plundered and divided up within your very walls. Ooh. I will gather all the nations to Jerusalem to fight against it. The city will be captured, the houses ransacked, and the women raped. Half of the city will go into exile, but the rest of the people will not be taken from the city. Then the Lord, L-O-R-D, all caps, Yahweh, then Yahweh will go out and fight against those nations as he fights on a day of battle. So just when all the nations are surrounding Israel, these people are going to come and know Messiah, they're going to come to Christ, they're going to realize that their sins are forgiven, these nations come in, they come to battle the Jewish people, and then God comes in and fights for Israel. Now catch this. On that day, his feet, L-O-R-D, all caps, Yahweh, on that day, Yahweh's feet will stand on the Mount of Olives. What did Jesus say in Acts chapter 1, verse 9? First he said, go into all the nations and preach the gospel, blah, blah, blah. And then in verse 9, he goes up from where? From the Mount of Olives. And the disciples are looking up into the sky, just going, whoa, where'd he go? And they look over and there's two angels standing there. And they're like, men, what are you doing? That Jesus who just went up, he's going to come down exactly the way that he came up. So he left from the Mount of Olives and he's going to come back to the Mount of Olives. On that day, his feet, Yahweh's feet, Jesus, will stand on the Mount of Olives east of Jerusalem, and the Mount of Olives will be split in two from east to west, forming a great valley with half of the mountain moving north and half moving south. So apparently when Jesus comes back, he's going to stand on the same mountain, and that mountain is going to be split right in half. Well, let's think about that for a second. How does an amillennial interpret this? Because from their perspective, come on, this can't be the... Jesus is literally coming back to the Jewish people. This has got to be referring to the church. And he can't be coming back to Jerusalem, because that's... No, Jerusalem has been replaced by the church. It can't be the Mount of Olives, because that's just a mountain. And it's the church. What do you... Come on, it's the church, the church. Here's Matthew Henry. He writes that the great mountain, what's this great mountain then? He says, it's the way of the Jews' conversion. Now, reading so far, would you have picked that up? So far we're reading, nations are coming to kill the Jews. The nations are surrounding. Yahweh returns. Yahweh literally returns on the Mount of Olives. Okay. And the what is the mountain? It's the Jews' conversion to Christ. And, quote, the valley of the mountains, that big valley between the two mountains that split, is the gospel church, to which there were added of the Jews daily such as should be saved, who fled that valley as to their refuge. The valley represents the church, and this all refers to how the Jews can come to Christ. If you can believe that interpretation, now you might be like, well, yeah, Matthew Henry, that's centuries old. Great. So you're quoting from like an old amillennial commentator. If you read recent amillennial commentators, guess who they quote here? They quote Matthew Henry. This is still the view held today. Well, if you can believe that, you can believe anything. I don't know how you can read this with a straight face and read this and it's saying mountains, women being raped, nations surrounded, and this is all referring to Jewish people coming to Christ. That's the interpretation. Give me a break. Verse 5, you will flee by my mountain valley, for it will extend to Azel. You will flee as you fled from the earthquake in the days of Uzziah, king of Judah. Then the Lord my God will come and all the holy ones with him. That's interesting. What's the pattern we're seeing? Nation surrounding, Yahweh intervenes, and an earthquake that arises. It will be a unique day, a day only known to the Lord, with no distinction between day and night. When evening comes, there will be light. On that day, living water will flow out from Jerusalem, half of it east to the Dead Sea and half of it west to the Mediterranean in summer and in winter. The Lord will be king over the whole earth. On that day, there will be one Lord and his name, the only name. It will be inhabited. Never again will it be destroyed. Jerusalem will be secure. This hasn't been fulfilled yet because Jerusalem is not secure. The people are not in their land. And we have seen it destroyed over and over. Well, so we've seen Daniel's picture. Nation surrounding, about to kill, God intervenes, earthquake. We saw Ezekiel's picture, nation surrounding, about to kill the Israelites, God intervenes, peace and serenity. We saw Zechariah's picture, nation surrounding, God's going to intervene, earthquake, God sets up security and safety forever. Now let's look at the book of Joel, Joel 3:12. Let the nations be roused. Let them advance into the valley of Jehoshaphat, for there I will sit to judge on all the nations on every side. Multitudes, multitudes in the valley of decision, for the day of the Lord is near in the valley of decision. The sun and the moon will be darkened and the stars no longer shine. The Lord will roar from Zion and thunder from Jerusalem. The earth and the heavens will tremble, but the Lord will be a refuge for his people, a stronghold for the people of Israel. Then you will know that I, the Lord your God, dwell in Zion, my holy hill. Jerusalem will be holy. Never again will foreigners invade her. What's the picture? Nations surrounding Israel, about to kill the Israelites. God shows up, roars, screams, yells, defends his nation, and then there's peace and serenity, and they're never invaded again. Never again will foreigners invade her. So are you guys tracking with me? Israel's in the land. They're surrounded by enemy nations. Yahweh God returns to fight for Israel. Yahweh judges the nations. Yahweh inaugurates an eternal kingdom. Isn't that the pattern we're seeing? This is correlation. All the prophets, in their own way, in their own voice, in their own language, are describing the same story. Again, these passages could not have been fulfilled already. They're future, and they're all pointing and giving us puzzle pieces to describe the same event. And this, my friends, is precisely what we read when we get to the book of Revelation. I've talked to so many people who say, well, we don't really know what the book of Revelation teaches. How could you really interpret it? And I've already argued against that. I've already said, wait a minute. If this is some kind of a mystery wrapped in an enigma, wrapped in a puzzle, why would it say that we're blessed, Revelation 1:3, if we just read it, let alone understand it? If we read it, we're going to get a blessing. If you know your Old Testament, and if you're reading your Old Testament, the book of Revelation comes into focus. So with that pattern in mind, which we've seen repeatedly, let's read Revelation 19:11. And I saw heaven opened, and behold, a white horse, and he who sat on it is faithful and true, and in righteousness he judges and wages war. This is the line that Johnny Cash drew for one of his songs, Revelation 19:11. Verse 14, the armies which are in heaven, clothed in fine linen, white and clean, were following him on white horses. From his mouth comes a sharp sword, so that with it he may strike down the nations, and he will rule them with a rod of iron, and he treads the winepress of the fierce wrath of God the Almighty. Oh, that's the same picture. Nations are coming in on Israel. And Jesus returns, and when he returns, he comes to judge, and he strikes down the nations. And on his robe and on his thigh, he has a name written, King of Kings and Lord of Lords. So he has a robe, a royal robe, and it's written there, and it's also, is it a tattoo on his thigh? Is Jesus all tatted up, King of Kings, Lord of Lords? And he just comes in with a sword, which is the word of God, it's his voice. The same word of God, which could speak the universe into existence, comes in and just speaks. And when the nations and the nukes and the army, everything, Jesus just comes in and it's just like, ah! You know, the Lord roars from Zion and it's just everyone just falls down. Game over, man. Then I saw an angel standing in the sun and he cried out with a loud voice, saying to all the birds which fly in the mid-heaven, come, assemble for the great supper of God, so that you may eat the flesh of kings and the flesh of commanders and the flesh of mighty men and the flesh of horses and of those who sit on them and the flesh of all men, both free men and slaves and small and great. So apparently there's going to be a lot of people who get killed when Jesus comes back. People, all these fruit flies are trying to attack the king, and the king just comes in and just obliterates them. And there's the great feast of the birds, calling to the birds, unclean animals. So I'm sure there's some symbolism here. Eating these dead bodies. Nasty. Then I saw the beast and the kings of the earth and their armies assembled to make war against him who sat on the horse and against his army. Well, you already see where this is headed. The beast was seized and with him the false prophet who performed the signs in his presence, by which he deceived those who had received the mark of the beast and those who worshipped his image. These two were thrown alive into the lake of fire, which burns with brimstone. What I really love about this section is when you're reading the book of Revelation up until this point, it's just so much chaos and evil and wickedness and persecution and bloodshed. And then when Jesus comes back, there isn't an iota of question as to who is in charge. When he comes to fight, it's just like, you ever heard that expression? You brought a knife to a gunfight. It's like you brought an army to a Jesus fight. And he's just going to completely, boom, knock you down. He's God. The rest were killed with the sword, which came from the mouth of him who sat on the horse. And all the birds were filled with their flesh. Man, is that graphic. And so. What happens in Revelation 20? Revelation 19 seems to fit, right? So you got like Revelation 19, where you got the nations coming to attack Israel and God's people, and then they're about to kill them, and then Messiah, the Lord, Yahweh, Jesus, comes back. He defends his people. He wipes out all the bad guys. And then Revelation 20, what do you have there? You have the millennial kingdom. That shows that we are reading this properly. That in Zechariah, that in Daniel, that in Ezekiel, that in Joel, we see nations, we see God intervening, and then we see a secure kingdom of God on earth. It'll never again be destroyed. And in Revelation 20, that's precisely what we see. At the end of Revelation 20, we see that the nations try and take another stab at Jesus, and he puts them down. It's not even a fight. And then we get the new heavens and new earth. But it's pretty convincing. It's pretty persuasive, in my estimation, that, you know, I wonder how we should interpret Revelation and the millennial kingdom. We interpret it exactly the same way we interpret the rest of the Old Testament prophecies. These synchronize, at least, at the very least, you have to concede, they synchronize on the main timeline. Well, as I've been arguing, correlation is one of the keys to biblical prophecy. You know you're getting off track when you can't correlate what your interpretation is with the other prophets, with the other books. However, when you can show the 3, 4, 5 different authors are all pointing to the same event, and this is all synchronizing and correlating, that showing, as the old expression says, the Bible is its best interpreter, that we're interpreting this properly. Maybe as you look at this, you say, wow, our view is pretty confusing. You better believe it's confusing. This is really confusing. However, what about that makes us think that it isn't true? You know what's confusing? The doctrine of the Trinity is confusing. Three persons in one God. There's one essence, but three persons. You know what else is confusing? The hypostatic union. That's pretty confusing. How can Jesus have two natures? That's confusing. I mean, you go right on down the line. And those are core doctrines, by the way. Like the deity of Jesus and the Trinity. Those are core doctrines. We're not even talking about core doctrine here. We're talking about doctrine that you could be a Christian and still disagree with everything I said. Not the second coming of Christ, obviously. But, you know, I mean, the details here, you could disagree. And yet, it is confusing, and why should we expect anything different? We're trying to piece this together. And I guess, again, I would just like to point out, it's better to struggle with these prophecies than to spiritualize them. In an amillennial viewpoint, like Matthew Henry, how do you interpret? How do you write commentaries on the Bible? What do you write? What is the mountain? Mount of Olives. That's the Jews' conversion. That's the church. What's the big crevice in between? Oh, that's the gospel church. I mean, you could just put church over everything in these prophecies. In my view, that just doesn't do justice to the text. And I see no reason to allegorize huge swaths of scripture when it's better to really try and figure out what is this text saying.